This is John Howell Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Justin Finch, another day in D.C., another Congressman George Santos revelation. Justin, welcome back to WLS. Sir, I'd like to get this off the table early in the show today. What's the latest on the fine congressman from Long Island?
Hey there, John. It depends on how you define the latest. There is so much, second after second. As of today, he really is trying to hit back at these claims that he was once a drag performer in Brazil. But popular Brazilian drag performer Yulia Richard tells ABC that he knew George Santos as Anthony DeVolder. He performed, though, as Kitara Ravash. Richard also sharing a photo he says was printed in the Grito Gay Rio paper showing Santos in drag. Santos is responding to this, going on Twitter and saying the most recent obsession from the media claiming that I am a drag queen or performed as a drag queen is categorically false. This comes within hours of him having to hit back at a veteran's claims that he pocketed money meant for his cancer-stricken dog.
Has the picture that we see now of allegedly Santos, or whatever the name was at that time, with the other performer in Brazil, has he said that's not me? Or has he said, well, I was goofing around, it was a Halloween party? Has he referenced that picture at all that's ricocheting around the media?
Santos has not directly addressed that photo. He has pretty much put all of his convictions behind that tweet, saying categorically, that's not him.
Has he elaborated on his work experience or personal finances recently?
Nothing of note as of late. When he is pressed with those questions, as he is frequently as he moves about the house, he says this is something that he has addressed. He has called them embellishments. There are others, investigators at the federal and state level, who call these lies, and they're looking deeper into it. George Santos, as of right now, appears to have some cover, some time. The House focused on other issues right now, but there is growing concern within his party that something needs to be done to address him as well.
Justin Finch is covering this developing story, this, we'll say, a very fluid story regarding Congressman George Santos. Do we know if, in fact, he has explained the allegations that he may have committed crimes in Brazil?
He has confessed to being in Brazil for a long time, as evidenced by some other factors, too. But he's leaving that to the investigators. I'm saying that he at one time had his hands on a checkbook down there, but the further investigation will bear him out.
He has said previously that his mother was in the World Trade Center on 9/11. That has been disproven, hasn't it?
ABC News has gotten their hands on some documents that show that his mother applied for a replacement green card in February of 2003 at the American consulate in Brazil. That, of course, is after 9/11. She also says that she had a replacement that she was looking for at that time, applying for that. Santos did say that she died some years after 9/11, but did not elaborate if her cancer was due to being at Ground Zero or in the towers. Nevertheless, it is another sore for him in his new start here in Washington.
And then finally, just to reiterate, he allegedly took some money meant to save a disabled veteran's dog. Is that the latest?
That is true. And Santos also going on Twitter to refute that. He says the reports that I would let a dog die is shocking and insane, adding that these distractions won't stop me. This veteran says that he was directed to Santos, who at the time says ran a charity to help animals. He says $3,000 were raised online, but he never got the money, saying that Santos took the money and his dog wound up dying from a tumor.
And finally, when your news editor in the morning says, Justin, you have to cover George Santos today, do you think to yourself, oh, please, can I just get something that's a little bit more relevant than this?
Well, sometimes the concern is, can I keep up? You know, it's just, there are just so many things, and every time you think you have your finger on it all, another thing bubbles up.
Well, he's not going anywhere. The Republicans need Republicans need that vote. Thank you, sir. Much appreciated. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Justin Finch in D.C. on George Santos.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
So Paul Vallis last night was talking about his plan regarding the CTA specifically to get rid of the private vendor with the dogs and put police on CTA trains and buses. Madam Mayor.
I have to say, Mr. Vallis clearly hasn't ridden the CTA or the bus or the rail in a very long time, because we do have uniform officers on the CTA, bus and rail, and we've increased them steadily over the course of the last year.
I guess that's good. Problem is, according to a survey of 2,000 regular riders of buses and trains, CTA customers, everything's late and everything smells like weed. Now we welcome our guest. John Wilmus is here. He's a professor at Roosevelt University. First-time guest on this program, but I read his comments, and they made me laugh out loud, and then they made me, just a little bit sad. Mr. Wilmus, welcome to WL, sir. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you said in the article, which I read in the Sun-Times, that you are a longtime defender of the Chicago Transit Authority, but you've reached a tipping point, a breaking point. Is that my understanding?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been in Chicago 13 years now. I've always loved it. I live now in Avondale, so I take the Addison Blue Line stop in, which historically would be a great place to get on in the morning, and you'd be guaranteed to have a seat. But now, because there's only a train like every 12 minutes during the morning rush hour, you're sardines right away. You can barely move. But when I moved to the city, I could get a seat, or at least nice standing room at Division Blue Line stop. Part of that is population growth, but I think most of it at this point is just the failure of the trains. They used to come every 2 or 3 minutes. Now it's every 12 minutes.
Have you tried the app that people complain so much about, where they see ghost trains and ghost buses and they never show?
I haven't actually had the ghost problem. Like, the things come when they say they're going to come. It's just not often enough. But no, I haven't tried the app because I'm not sure that it does anything. I'm not sure that anything is going to happen unless we have like a budget that cares about the CTA and a mayor that maybe cares about it enough to give them budget. Like, they're constantly putting up these police recruiting advertisements, and they post the number of the starting salary, which is like really high. It's like $85,000 or something. I never see anything like that from recruiting CTA conductors. So that's what I think probably needs to happen, but there's no sign that it's going to.
CTA, which is the second largest transit system in the U.S., they're fighting their way back. Obviously, the pandemic, shortages of operators, a big culture shift towards remote work from home, and, of course, crime. Do you still feel safe on the CTA, Mr. Wilmus?
I mostly feel safe. I have seen some weird things happening that, I can understand why make people feel unsafe, but most of what I see, actually, instead of it making me feel unsafe, it just makes me feel sad. Honestly, there's a lot of like homeless people and mentally ill people on the trains. I don't consider that a CTA problem. I consider that a problem caused by lack of resources and help elsewhere. I can understand why it makes people uncomfortable or feel safe, but sometimes I think that people saying they don't feel safe, it's just like a more convenient way for them to say that they don't want to look at a homeless person and consider their suffering.
It's a huge problem in the city. I mean, not far from you, we were talking about one of the city parks that essentially has been turned over to a homeless encampment since the pandemic started. In some ways, it's been exacerbated by people trying to do the right thing and giving the homeless these ice fishing tents, which are good all year round, and help them survive the cold weather, but that exacerbates the problem. And the park, and I can't remember off the top of my head which park it was, but essentially they just had to, the parents and the kids that would normally use the park have had to find different facilities because now it's considered to be a homeless encampment, and we've got to solve that problem. All major cities do. In fact, even small towns as well. We're talking here with John Wilmus, professor at Roosevelt University. What do you teach, sir?
English.
I wish I had taken more English classes in my day.
You just tell that to my sisters. They don't want to take them. So,
I know.
Yeah. They, if they could hear themselves 20, 30 years later, they'd feel differently. But
a lot of ahs and a lot of likes and a lot of this, that, and the others.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I thought your comments were very germane to this story, and I appreciate you popping on with us. So you're looking for a job where it's going to be close to home, so you no longer have to even utilize a CTA. Is that my understanding?
Yeah, that's actually true. I've been applying and interviewing for things to work remotely. I mean, I might end up staying where I'm at if none of the offers or opportunities are good enough, and just hope that the CTA gets better. I used to love going downtown all the time. But yeah, it's a daily stressor that it's in the morning, it's in the afternoon, and it's just like, do I even know that the train is going to come? I've waited like an hour for it before. And yeah, I also think that something that a comment they didn't publish in the story is that I think the train regularity is also like part of a safety plan. I think weird things happen when people are standing around frustrated and aggrieved that they can't get to where they need to be because of delays.
Yeah.
I think that an expedient system is fundamentally a safer system as well.
Well, I recommend all my listeners to go to the Sun-Times website today and read this. It's a very long, comprehensive article about the 2,000 CTA riders that were surveyed. Everybody basically says, we can't count on it, everything is late, and everything smells like weed. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Rachel, jump on. Let's discuss what's happened to Mr. John Drummond's number. We talked to him yesterday, didn't we?
We did, John. I called him at the number that he gave me, and we had a nice chat. And now it's just saying this number is not accepting any calls, no matter what I call him from. So, John, if you're listening, give us a call.
A bulldog, 312-591-8900. So he, our phones are working, correct? Is this our problem by chance?
It's not our problem. I also tried on my cell phone and I got a similar error message.
Okay. All right. We'll just keep trying to, maybe he blocked his calls to do the radio interview. He's a pro.
That's what Tyler said as well. So yeah. I'm hoping he's tuning in or wondering where we are, but he did also call in yesterday. So he has our number as well.
And you're sure that we're using the right number?
I am positive.
Okay. All right, we'll try to get a hold of him. By the way, I read his book. It's terrific. Let me just give a plug for his book. 30 Years in the Trenches, Covering Crooks, Characters, and Capers. So this is a bulldog, John Drummond. You saw him for years and years and years on Channel 2. And the reason we wanted to talk to him, and actually he reached out to me earlier this week and said, hey, do you realize it's been 40 years since Dorfman was whacked. I don't think he used the term whacked. Was killed right there in Lincolnwood at the Purple Hotel, which was then a Hyatt. And he and associate apparently had just gone to the bank, and Mr. Dorfman had given his associate a check, and then they were going to have a little breakfast at the Hyatt, and supposedly somebody attempted to rob them, and the two guys attempted to rob these guys in the parking lot, but probably wasn't a robbery since they didn't take anything. And at that time, and I just went back and looked at this, today, Channel 2, I think they probably had almost 15 minutes worth of coverage on this when it happened 40 years ago this week, including a nice report from, hopefully, our next guest, the Bulldog, John Drummond.
Alan Dorfman always traveled in the fast track. Immaculately dressed and with the perpetual tan, Dorfman appeared on the surface, at least, to be the epitome of success. AD, as his friends called him, meetings on a first-name basis with powerful politicians, union bigwigs, and Hollywood stars. But he was also close to organized crime figures, and that may have been his undoing.
The guy looked slick. He dressed well, looked great. He was very, very wealthy, ran an insurance agency here, consultant to the Teamsters pension fund, picked up a little dough from that.
Through the years, Dorfman, who turned 60 earlier this month, amassed a fortune. He controlled the Amalgamated Insurance Agency of Chicago, which processed insurance claims for Teamsters union members. Partly through Amalgamated, Dorfman had a grip on Teamster pension fund loans, land transactions, as well as major insurance deals.
He had been a long-time business associate of Jimmy Hoffa. Of course, Jimmy Hoffa took an extended vacation a few years before Dorfman was killed. He was also, they think, associated, perhaps, with a Chicago outfit. Dorfman had been convicted on several felony counts, and he had been in trouble previously, but on lesser charges.
But despite his jet-set lifestyle, Dorfman had his brushes with the law. He served 9 months in prison in the early 1970s for accepting a $55,000 kickback on a pension fund loan. In another case, in 1975, he was tried on a fraud charge, but he was acquitted after a lengthy trial at the Dirksen Federal Building.
In 79, the FBI launched what they called Operation Pendorf. That was a combination of penetration and Dorfman. Operation Pendorf. And they installed, yes, the old hidden microphones in Dorfman's insurance agency. And as a result of that information, the FBI pinched him. And he had been told, stay off the phone, stay off the phone.
I've been telling you your whole life, don't talk on phone, right? Now you understand, huh?
It's going to be okay. I think you got a good chance of beating the case.
Well, he didn't beat the case. He was convicted and he was due to be sentenced.
But recently the roof caved in on Dorfman. Last month, he, along with Teamsters head Roy Williams and three other men, were convicted on bribery conspiracy charges. He was scheduled to be sentenced on February 10th and faced a lengthy jail term.
So he was convicted December of 82. Roy Lee Williams, the Teamster. Also, Joseph Lombardo, Joey the Clown. He was convicted of conspiring to bribe Howard Cannon, who was a Democrat senator from Nevada, to oppose deregulation of over-the-road trucking laws. So that's what this stemmed from. And in 3 days before the sentencing, bad things happen.
He was also scheduled to go on trial later this year in a case involving the late Robert Kendler, a developer and nationally known handball player. The government claimed that Dorfman and reputed crime syndicate figure Joey the Clown Lombardo conspired to extort $800,000 from Kendler. Kendler's expensive Lake Forest home was bombed, and officials contended that Dorfman and Lombardo were behind the bombing incident.
That voice belongs to the legendary Bulldog John Drummond, who joins us now on WDLS. Bulldog, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Well, welcome back. We had a phone problem here. My regular phone went dead on me, dead as a mackerel, but we finally got through, and I'm sorry to put you up to such inconvenience.
Well,
but you've been running an awful lot about it already. I have nothing to say.
Well, you know, I was watching those reports earlier today, and they were so great, and CBS gave you a lot of time. It was a big story, obviously. I guess my first question is, do you suspect, well, number one, we all know, because he was due to go inside for a long time, and as an associate of the outfit, you have a target on your back because they always think that you're going to flip on them. The feds are probably going to try to flip them. Do you think,
John, here's what really puts it. He was several days before the assassination was on the 20th, but he was scheduled a couple of days later to be in San Francisco, where a grand jury had returned an indictment against him and two other men in connection with a labor union scam. And what the Ayupin company, according to the authorities, the mob bosses were concerned with, he might be remanded to custody out there in San Francisco, and that there's no chance at all to take care of him. He could spill mob beans. He's 6 years old. They didn't think he could handle a long prison term. And so he had to be taken out. And so they did it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in a suburban, outside of a suburban hotel, which was unprecedented to do it. And they got away with it.
Dorfman must have known, correct? I mean, obviously put two and two together. He knew everything that you just said, and he knew what the mob normally does with guys they think they're going to flip. So why was he out and about?
Well, he was picked up by his friend Irving Weiner, by the way, who was a bail bondsman. And why they went to the hotel, the authorities always felt he was set up, that they knew, that the mob knew he was coming to lunch there. Weiner claimed, on the other hand, they were together. He picked Weiner up in the morning. They stopped off, by the way, at a video store and bought a copy of The Verdict with Paul Newman. I remember that was the last thing that Dorfman did. Went to the hotel where there were three people, two guys waiting for him and a guy in a car. And so obviously they must have known about it. Lord Weiner claimed, no, they must have followed us. Weiner never told anybody where they were going to have lunch.
And they yelled Lord out, Weiner, they yelled out, this is a robbery, but nothing was taken. Right. And only Dorfman got it. Weiner just stood there.
That's correct. I think that Dorfman was shot about eight times, believe it or not, with a .22, which was the weapon of choice in those days for the outfit. That killed Sam Giancana as well. And Dwight Weiner was there. Weiner could not hardly recognize anybody who they were. They were not masked. Then after the shooting, the two men put masks on and fled the scene.
Think those guys were eliminated too, the killers?
No. Well, we don't. One of the suspects at the time, or managers of interest, was a guy named Ray Spencer, who was sort of an unknown. But he was about 6'2", 235 pounds, which fit the description of one of the killers. And the Justice Department told me he was a prime one of the suspects in the case. And about a year later, he drowned, I guess, in the Atlantic Ocean. Why, I don't know. The other two were not. The other suspects, of course, the usual people, Paul the Indian Shiro, Frankie Schweiz, the German, and John Fecorata, other names surface as possibly the ones involved in it. But nobody was ever charged, nobody was ever indicted, and nothing ever happened in the Dorfman case until today, and nothing is going to happen now.
Whatever happened to Irwin Weiner?
Weiner himself died of natural causes. And by the way, he also was a defendant with Dorfman in that case you mentioned earlier in one of your pieces, when in 1974, 75, that Dorfman beat the federal rap over in the Dirksen building after a key witness had been murdered, a witness by the name of Daniel Seifert.
Did we ever figure out if, in fact, Alan Dorfman was Paul Red Dorfman's son, or was he a stepson?
He was his son, either adopted or regular. I don't know what he was his son. That's correct.
And the old man, the senior Red Dorfman, he was also connected with the outfit because he ran the Waste Haulers Union.
That's correct. He was indirect. That's correct. He was considered an outfit associate. That is right. The late Red Dorfman. Correct.
And how close
Alan was following in his shoes, so to speak.
Yeah. Boy, he was a snappy dresser, wasn't he, Dorfman?
Oh, he always had a perpetual tan on. When he was on trial in the fall of 1982, where he was convicted along with Lombardo and Williams of bribing a U.S. senator, he came into that courtroom every day just with a tan on, a beautiful coat, suit, very arrogant. And one of the jurors told me afterwards, one of the things they didn't like about Dorfman, he was too arrogant. He had that perpetual tan on here in the winter. Obviously, he'd gone to a tanning salon. There was something about Dorfman that turned people off. He was very arrogant. There's no question about that.
And just to reiterate, he possibly was going in for 55 years, so the outfit said, okay, that's enough.
He was 60 years old. He had a lengthy fix and a lengthy prison term. They said they don't think he could take that much time, but he could bring particularly Ayub and company were concerned that he could bring the house down. And so we had to do something about it, and that's what they did, and got away with it.
Do you still enjoy retirement, or do you miss the action?
Oh, I enjoy retirement. Stories, of course, obviously a story like Dorfman, a major political story, something like that is always a challenge. It would be, but as was the Dorfman case, those stories, of course, you remember very well. That's for sure. Oh, that, for example, that anniversary, the Tylenol case, things like that bring back memories. And those are you do like to get answered like a fire horse. You never, when the bell rings, I like to get out in the action then.
Yeah. Well, it's great talking to you. I want to plug the book again. I thought it was terrific.
Listen, thank you. Sorry for the delay on the phone. I don't know what was going on here. That phone is deader than a mackerel, the other one. So we'll find out what happened. I don't know.
Can we call on your memories again?
You certainly any time. In fact, there's another. Might give you. I'm not going to hit it, but right now there's another good 40th anniversary coming up in February, and I'll call Rachel.
Okay, terrific. All right, terrific.
All right.
All right,
have
John.
A good day and a good weekend.
You too, sir. John Drummond,
thanks,
the
John.
Bulldog, joining us here. The book, 30 Years in the Trenches, covering crooks, characters, and capers. It's absolutely terrific, as is John Drummond.
As Dorfman's world collapsed around him, underworld elements may have felt that Dorfman might cooperate with the feds in an effort to avoid jail.
I want it to be very clear. Mr. Dorfman at no time cooperated in the past or currently with the FBI or the Justice Department, and therefore I want it very clear that his death whatever happened today was not the result of his cooperation because he was not cooperating.
By the way, that is a very young Dan Webb. That's a very young Dan Webb.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching the Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Well, as we talked about a couple times earlier in the program, the Des Plaines Theater, the operator, cancels a conservative group's event set for February 8th after, well, some would say threats, certainly a lot of consternation and outcry against this group. The group we're talking about is Awake Illinois. They have, according to the Daily Herald, they've been in the news, they have railed against suburban drag events, medical treatments for transgender youth, and the state's new sex education standards, among other topics. That's from the Daily Herald. So we've heard of Awake Illinois previously, and you may recognize this voice. He's been on the air with me a number of times, representing an Italian-American group and his own company, Onesti Entertainment. Ron Onesti, welcome back. How are you, sir?
What's up, Big Jen?
Did you by chance get a chance to hear the mayor of Des Plaines on this program at the top of the hour?
I did not. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Were you aware that this rental in particular would receive a lot of attention when they booked the venue?
Well, no, John, and that's the actual, you know, essence of the situation here. I mean, you know, we're a rental venue, a facility. We have a lot of different events. Something comes in that says the Coalition for Kids and has a diverse group on paper of speakers. There were one or two gay organizations represented, African-American, Asian-American, Latin-American, women. I mean, it seemed like a very diverse group. Nothing really, you know, I didn't deep dive into what it was all about because it was just a venue rental that we had.
Yeah. So, and again, this wouldn't even be probably an issue if it was a private, you know, banquet hall or venue, but because the city owns it, you operate it under a contract, you operate it. But if it was a private event, you could return the, you know, you could either hold the event should you decide to, and I know you don't want to, you're not into this either side politically, but you could hold it, or you could say, you know, I'd rather not here. It's a private event. Here's your deposit. See you later. Thank you. No harm, no foul. But I guess my second question, and you were somewhat oblique about this in your statement, so was the mayor. What did the city officials themselves put any pressure on you to cancel this? The mayor says no.
No, I mean, I didn't hear a word from him, actually. You know, and what you just represented isn't necessarily the situation, at least in my mind. I mean, you know, this is a people said this is a publicly funded theater, and no, the renovation was publicly funded, but this is a for-profit business. It's a private enterprise, and I do have the decision on what is here or not, and I'm proud of that because I feel that I've handled that in a responsible fashion for 18 years in St. Charles and for the past 3 years here in Des Plaines. I've had the place only been open a year, but you know, I just thought we were providing an opportunity for a healthy discussion about sensitive issues, and I didn't know what they would be. I mean, I didn't know how controversial this would be.
Yeah, and the other thing is,
it really,
yeah, you were trying to fill a date. Everybody totally understands that. It's like you weren't an advocate on either side here, at least in reading your statement. And I know you. I mean, you're not an advocate. You weren't doing this to be politically, you know, personally. You weren't trying to get into politics here. You're just trying to book an event for a for-profit facility.
Well, I just went through our regular system. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, we don't really like vet all these different things and you know, check people's, you know,
yeah, who they are,
situation or their criminal record or whatever, you know.
Do you realize you're going to get it from both sides now?
You know what, John, that's the sad thing. The sad thing is the amount of hate that came out of this. I mean, I didn't necessarily cancel it, you know, totally because of threats. I mean, the threats are really, really, like, mean and nasty. But what they were doing was dragging me painting me into a corner of having a position on this issue. And that wasn't my role. You know, what my personal position of this issue is wasn't my role here. I mean, it was strictly to rent the venue. And then now people were labeling me and coming out at me that I was homophobic and I'm against this and against that. I'm like, no, I just rented the venue. And that's what really started getting to me, where, you know, people are assigning me a position rather than me giving my own.
I'm not going to mention the guy's name, but you would know him because he's in the same business. We both have dealt with this guy in the past. But there's a man that runs a venue similar to yours, who now, I was talking to him recently, probably in the last year or so, not on the air, but I said, how are the bookings going? He goes, in this day and age, he books comedians like you do from time to time. He goes, I have to be so careful even booking comedians now, because there's going to be pushback on every single comedian from one side or the other every single time, and I don't want to put my place at risk.
Well, you know, again, I have to, at some point, you have to, you know, I have to be concerned of how these decisions affect the community, the business, my family. I mean, it's safety here, you know. I mean, that is a concern, but, you know, I want to make it clear, it's not backing down from anybody who decides a threat, you know, don't like something, well, let's just threaten them and they'll cancel it. That's not the case. It was more about me dragged into having a position when I really didn't have one.
Yeah. Well, you do now. I mean,
I feel
for you. I'm in the business. I get it all the time, too. Not only get threats like this, but, you know, now that you have canceled the event, here comes the red wave after what I would describe as the blue wave. So you're just going to get hit by both sides now.
Well, you know what? I think so. You know, and again, being in the public type business, I mean, I understand the situation, but I don't, you know, I don't take First Amendment situations lightly. I think that is something very, very important, and that's where I was going with this. You know, the same rules and laws that govern the people's ability to have these opinions also protect those that want to protest them. And so I thought, you know, it would be a healthy situation, but then it got really ugly.
Well, the protests, that's not a problem. If you protest peacefully and lawfully, that's not a problem. The threats, those are the problem. Yeah.
Well, that's it. The threats and just, you know, it really took the eye off the ball of the issues at a certain point, John. It was like, you know, it's not about the issues at hand. It was more about the event and who's going to do what to who. And, like, come on, what's going on here?
Yeah. On a different note, in your many, many years of booking entertainment, did you have any interactions with David Crosby?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, we did a show with him just before COVID, and what a wonderful guy. I mean, we all know this about him, but just an intelligent individual. We had great conversations. I really want to talk about Laurel Canyon, a lot of the early days, and he gave me some great stories. And it was funny because he did his sound check downstairs in the theater, of course. It was about 4 o'clock. And then come about 5:30, where everyone's looking for him. They can't find him. He found his way all the way up to the third floor into the speakeasy, found a couch, and he was laying down on the couch with his shoes off, sound asleep.
You mentioned Laurel Canyon. I saw that documentary. Have you seen that documentary about the singer-songwriters in Laurel Canyon out in L.A.?
Holy smokes, it's hard to believe that is a nonfiction situation.
Yeah, it's a great documentary, and David Crosby's a big part of it. I always wonder why that guy just didn't get himself to a barber. Did you ever think that when you were talking to him personally?
Too much work for him. He was, you could tell, he was like he just was a guy that just, I mean, really, that whole, it was symbolism. Him laying there with his bare feet, his shoes off, bare feet, laying on the couch. Yeah. I mean, I thought that, I saw that as a symbol. You know, it really painted a picture of David Crosby.
You can refuse to answer this.
He wouldn't even trim his mustache for crying out loud.
He didn't trim anything. His hair was wild. Ear hair, nose hair, mustache, the whole thing. I just never figured out why he never tucked his shirt in. You don't have to answer this. Was he clean when he worked for you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I assume so. I mean, there was nothing over. I mean, you could see it was relatively eccentric anyway. But again, you know, the conversations were pretty deep. I mean, I think it was a very smart guy, a very, you know,
oh, yeah.
a very thought, a yeah. very well outspoken person, actually.
That you know, cost him a lot of friendships, and he was, you know, he's prickly. There's no doubt about it. That comes from high intellect, obviously. So, yeah. All right. Well, Ron, thank you very much for popping on. I appreciate it. I wish it was under better circumstances.
Well, you know, anytime I'm on air with you, Big John Howell, it's a great circumstance. I wish you the best, brother.
Look forward to seeing you soon.
Yeah, man.
Have a good weekend. Ron Onesti from the Displains Theater. Oh, you'll be seeing and hearing more about this story. It'll percolate all weekend long, I'm sure.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.